Jovan Buha! Buha!
Yo, yo! I'm Jovan Buha, NBA reporter and analyst for Buha's Block, and welcome to another mailbag. It's been a minute since we've done one of these, but I posted on the Buha's Block Discord that I was going to be doing a mailbag, and you guys submitted a bunch of questions, so going to be splitting this into a two-part mailbag. If you want to take part in future Discord mailbags, be sure to join the Buha's Block Discord. The link is in the show notes. Without further ado, let's get into it. The first question is from a couple of people because they were along the same lines. First one from Jord Santiago. What roster need do you want to be surely addressed? And then second one from Bronny. What position group needs the most improvement? Me personally, I think center, since Ayton and Hayes both got destroyed by Chet and Ihart. Well, I think there are two positions that need to be improved, and they are two positions I've been talking about for years with the Lakers, and I've been talking about more recently over the past week as I have started to lay the foundation for a lot of the offseason content on the show. But first and foremost, I think the center position, to Bronny's point, needs to be addressed. I don't think DeAndre Ayton and Jackson Hayes are a good enough combination, especially when you look at the top teams in the West are not going anywhere. And with OKC, they have Isaiah Hartenstein and Chet Holmgren, who did thoroughly outplay DA and Jackson in this series. You have San Antonio with Victor Wembanyama, Denver with Nikola Jokic, Minnesota with Gobert and Reed, and then Houston with Şengün. Like, DA was able to hold his own and outperform him in several games, but Şengün also had a couple of big games, and he's a young player in his early 20s who is an all-star, will likely make All-NBA third team this year, or at least get some votes for it, and you know, should be a better player moving forward. So the competition at the top of the West is all-star and All-NBA type level centers. And I think the Lakers are going to have to put together a better center group than an $8 million player in DeAndre Ayton and a $3.5 million player, $4 million player in Jackson Hayes. Now, you could argue that both players, based on their regular season production, should be paid more. With DA, it really depends what he wants, what he's looking for. I think if he does opt in and stay with the Lakers, it will most likely be in a bench role, but maybe the Lakers invest in the wing position, which I'm about to touch on, and DA is just a placeholder center, and maybe they add another minimum guy and they go with a three-headed center rotation and have some more insurance in case DA isn't playing well, or maybe it's not a great matchup for Jackson. Maybe you add a different type of center on a cheap deal that gives you just a different look, and you could go with DA, that center, or Jackson, depending on the night, depending on the matchup, depending on how they're performing. So it gives you a little bit of flexibility there. It's more center by committee. But the other position is the wing spot. And this would probably be my preference in terms of addressing. Again, I think ideally you address both. But as I've stated recently, I think it's more difficult to find an elite two-way wing. Those guys are either incredible bargains on rookie scale contracts and their teams are not looking to trade them, or they get paid handsomely and they're making $25+ million and they're still difficult to trade for and acquire. And if you look at, like, I would love a Jaden McDaniels on the Lakers. They're not getting him unless they're willing to give up Austin Reeves in a trade. And even then, I'm not sold that Minnesota would do that. Like, I think both sides would want picks, and I just, it would be a tough negotiation. Those, like, elite all defense level wings who I think the Lakers would love to slot next to Luka Doncic and Austin Reeves, those guys are just really difficult to acquire. I think LA needs a true two-way wing who can move Marcus Smart into a bench role. And it's not because Marcus isn't good enough. I think he was their fourth best player overall this season, and I think he'd be stepped up in a huge way, especially once Luka and Austin went out. It's more so like Marcus has dealt with multiple injuries over the last few years. And I think as he's in his early 30s now, you just want to be careful about overtaxing him. I think if Marcus is your sixth or seventh man, you're in a pretty good position roster wise. And so I think the Lakers need to acquire a new starting center and a new two-way wing. Now, it's easier said than done. And it's like, there's also an element of, I've said this before, but I think it's whichever one is easier to acquire, or whichever one, you know, whether that's free agency or via trade, if Lu Dort becomes available or Isaiah Hartenstein becomes available, Jalen Suggs becomes available, whoever becomes available, that you feel like can fit that slot of what you need, I think you go down that path. But between the two, I do think it's harder to find the two-way wing. So if you have an avenue to acquire that player, I think you go down that, and maybe you could piece together the center rotation again, but at least add one more center, or maybe DA opts out and then you replace him with like a Robert Williams or Mitchell Robinson, something like that. But those are the two biggest needs for me, in addition to retaining Austin, retaining LeBron, hopefully retaining Marcus and Rui. If you could add those two positions and go into next year with a new center and a new wing, plus Luka, Austin, and LeBron, and then also have Marcus and Rui as your sixth and seventh men, I really like that top seven. Maybe Jackson's your eighth man, or you find a bargain with the room exception or a minimum exception. That player's your eighth man. Jackson's your ninth man. And that's your top nine. I really like that. And that might require getting off some salary with Vando or Jake LaRavia or Dalton Connect. And that will require attaching draft compensation. And then that also limits your ability to use that draft compensation in trades to acquire some players that could fit that starting role. So it's complicated and a difficult task for Rob Pelinka and the Lakers front office. But if you're just asking me straight up, like what I think the Lakers need, I think they need a starting level center and then a two-way wing who's a bit bigger than Marcus, younger, more athletic, ideally better than him defensively. But there's going to have to be some tough decisions made to truly address some of these concerns. But if we're talking ideal offseason, perfect offseason here, I think it's two new starters, slotting some starting level guys a little bit lower in the rotation, and finding guys who really complement Luka, Austin, and LeBron at the highest level. Next question from Maddie the Ace. This was submitted before game four. So he says, assuming LA gets swept or loses in five, if you're going to overpay for an RFA, who is it and why? Additionally, if you could bring back one of Rui or Kennard, which do you pick? I'll start with the second part of this question first, because I think it's the easiest one to answer. I would pick Rui. I just think Rui is a better overall player. He is bigger. He is more athletic. He is better defensively. He's a better rebounder. And it allows, we did see OKC and Houston target him off the dribble at times, but it's not an entry point into the defense the same way that Luke Kennard is. So I think he's much closer to being a league average defender than Luke Kennard is. I would put Luke Kennard as a bottom 10th percentile defender in the league. And I think we saw that at times in the playoffs. So when you factor in the size, the athleticism, the physicality, the defensive ability, and honestly, I think the offensive aggression, like if I had one thing to criticize Luke Kennard about, would be after the first couple games of the Houston series, he was just far less aggressive. And of course, Houston schemed him, or tried to scheme him out with putting Amon Thompson on him, and OKC played him similarly. But and there's still value in the gravity and just him being a shooting threat out there. He still had a couple of nice shooting performances after those first couple of games. But I don't think he quite gave you the level of production you wanted or frankly needed. And he was a major defensive liability. So I think between the two, I would heavily lean Rui. Now, the exception here, Rui making 20 plus million versus Luke Kennard making 8 million. I might prefer Luke at that point, but in a vacuum, if you're just saying who's the better player, who would I rather have? It's easily Rui. I think that will be reflected in their free agent value and their market this summer. I think it'll be reflected in the contracts they get. As for the first part of this question, which RFA would I want to overpay and why? I think two guys stand out above the rest of the pack. It's Walker Kessler and Peyton Watson. And we just talked about the Lakers need a center upgrade and they need a starting wing upgrade, and either one of these guys would check that box. In the case of Walker Kessler, I compare him to Rudy Gobert Light. If you look at his numbers compared to DeAndre Ayton, for example, he's a better rebounder. He is a similar level finisher around the basket and even within 3 to 10 feet. Like, he's got hook shots and floaters, and is not the mid-range shooter. Like, I would say DA's got a clear advantage as that short roll catch it, you know, pocket pass, drain that like 10 to 15 foot jumper. Walker Kessler doesn't quite have that, but within 10 feet, he's similar level of finisher to Ayton, but he's a bit bigger. I think he's got better hands. He is actually a better lob threat. And if you look at his dunks, he's consistently been 120 plus dunks in his first three seasons of his career. Last year, he got injured with the shoulder stuff. Also, Utah was tanking, so they had no incentive to have him play through it or return. So he had season ending shoulder injury, which maybe drives his price down a little bit. But if I'm going to overpay for a player in the offseason, I think Walker Kessler is a perfect fit. He can be a defensive system unto himself and would allow LA to play, I think, some more drop coverage. Like, you're not going to be switching with him, but I think he can play a high drop. He can play a low drop and would give LA a true rim protector, because I think that was one of the things that flew under the radar. The Lakers were one of the worst rim protecting teams in the league this season. They were a bottom three team in terms of rim field goal percentage allowed, and that would be much different with Walker Kessler. And don't just look at the block numbers, but actually watch the film on him and also look at the rim field goal percentage allowed. He is a much better rim protector than DeAndre Ayton. He would check a lot of the boxes, and I'd be willing to go up to about $35 million annually, average annual value for Walker Kessler. I wouldn't want to pay that. I'd prefer it to be around $30 million or $32, somewhere in the low 30s. But if we're talking like absolute max I would pay him, I would go up to $35 million, and that would be something I'm aggressive with. The other guy is Peyton Watson, who really popped this year in Denver as a shot creator, also really improved as a three-point shooter and was able to scale up his volume and increase his three-point percentage, which those two things often don't go hand in hand necessarily. So you look at him, he's a multi-positional defender. He actually guards down pretty well, but can guard like-size guys, so I think he can play the three or the four. Now, in terms of Knox, like, there's been some injury stuff with him, including the hamstring injury that he dealt with that kept him out of the end of the season. I think the rebounding isn't quite where you want it. It's above average, but he's not an elite rebounder. He's not a great rebounder, but his defensive versatility and his athleticism, his ability to get out transition, his ability to be a play finisher, whether that's as a cutter, a spot up guy, or even ISOs and running pick and roll. Like, I think Peyton Watson is a Swiss Army knife who could do a little bit of everything. With Watson, I would say probably high 20s to 30-ish million. I think the absolute most I'd pay him is $32 million, but I'd prefer to keep that closer to 28-30 and see if that's enough to pry him from Denver. So those would be my two guys. To a lesser degree, I would say Jalen Duren. I know a lot of people are out on him right now, and he has had a rough postseason, to say the least. There's been some processing stuff with him that just has not been to the level. Some people have even compared him to DeAndre Ayton and the way that he's regressed in the playoffs, kind of similar to Ayton. I think overall, his physicality and motor are still higher than DA's. And as a 22-year-old, I wouldn't feel great about paying him like $40 million, but if there was a way to get him under that, and if there was a way to get him more in the Walker Kessler price range or even a little bit lower, I would be open to that. But I think it's going to probably take something around 40-ish million to get Detroit to really think about it. And at that point, I'm probably just out on Duren at that price. If you could get him out of value, I think that's a different story. But based on the playoff struggles that he's had this postseason, I would be hesitant to, I just would worry he's potentially a playoff dropper. Now, I do think he's young enough that we could be looking at this when he's 25, 26 and being like, remember that 2026 postseason, like, remember, you know, he kind of struggled, but like, you know, it's a distant memory and he's just a monster. And like, this is a guy who got all defensive votes. He was an all-star this year. He's probably going to make all-NBA third team. There's a proven nature with him that even if he's not quite that player in the playoffs, I still think he's not quite this bad. So I think you'd be betting on the upside. You'd be viewing him almost as like a buy low guy. 30 to 32, maybe 33, I'd go max. The other guy would be Tari Eason. He wanted 25 plus million going into the season. I don't think he's going to get that. So if he's somewhere in that like $15 to $18 million range, I would be open to that. And I think he could slot in as the starting wing and then move Marcus to a bench role. And it could be a situation where Marcus even closes over him. I wouldn't be opposed to that, but I would feel better about things adding a guy like Tari Eason. Now, The shooting is a bit of a concern because the first half of the season, he was an above 40% three-point shooter. The second half of the season, he was a below 30% three-point shooter. He did find his footing progressively in the series against the Lakers, but his shot just really fluctuates. Now, if you look at his career, he's about a league average shooter. He's has a couple years above league average, a couple years below league average, but he's always in that 34 to 36% range. So I think taking that at face value, like that's just the type of shooter he is. So it's fine. And I think he'd get a higher shot quality in LA than he got in Houston. But you just have to bake that in that there is going to be some shooting variance with him. But I think the part that most appeals to me is the athleticism, the physicality, the length, the job he did at times against LeBron. I thought he did the best job against LeBron of maybe anyone in the playoffs. Like, I guess you could throw Dort in there. LeBron had his way, to be clear, in the post a lot. I just think he's a pretty good defender, but it's also the rebounding. He's a good rebounder. Now, I think we saw in the series against the Lakers, like, he can struggle sometimes with decision-making processing. He can have some really bad turnovers. But I think at the right price, I would be open to Tari Eason. If it's $20 million or above, I think that's too expensive. Even 18, I'm a little like non-taxpayer MLE level money, 100%. I'm in a little bit more, maybe anything more than that. I think, you know, 20-ish is where I start to probably be out on him. But, you know, they're the four names. I would say Kessler, Watson, Durin, Eason, probably in that order. Next one from LeGoat. Come the offseason, should the Lakers prioritize a premier center such as Allen, Claxton, etc., and wing depth like Feibel, Oubre, etc., or a premier wing like Watson, Suggs, etc., and center depth like Robert Williams? This is a great question and in line with a lot of the conversation we've had up to this point. Between the two, I would prioritize the premier wing and go with the cheaper centers, especially with the two names you mentioned in particular. Like, I like Allen, I like Claxton. I think there are questions about, at least with Allen, we've seen at times maybe like the toughness or the physicality in the playoffs hasn't been exactly what you've wanted. We haven't seen Nick Claxton in the playoffs in several years, but I would assume that would be a similar limitation. Now, that doesn't mean they don't have utility. That doesn't mean they don't have value. I think between the two, I'd actually probably prefer Claxton, especially because he's a little bit cheaper than Allen. Yeah, Allen's a better rebounder. He's a little bit bigger than Claxton. So, I mean, they're pretty similar guys in terms of their strengths and weaknesses. I think Claxton's a little bit more versatile defensively, but both are athletic and nimble and good lob threats. Claxton's also got, I think, some DHO and passing around the elbows and above the arc to a different level than Allen. But I would probably prefer, I guess it if it's just like, if you could get Robert Williams and a Watson or a Suggs, I would prefer that. For me, this is really context based in terms of I need to know like the specific names. For example, if you said Peyton Watson and Robert Williams or Jalen Suggs and Robert Williams versus like Claxton and Thybulle or Claxton and Oubre, I would take the Watson / Suggs plus Robert Williams side of it. But if you say like Kessler or Durin plus one of those cheaper wings, I might take that side. So it really depends on the specific names for me. In general, I would err on the side of the two-way wings being slightly harder to acquire and you having better odds of finding some bargain on the center market. Whereas two-way wings, it's hard for them to be undervalued. It's hard for them to be overlooked. There are always exceptions, but if you are a two-way wing of a certain caliber, you're going to be paid at a high level. So I just think it's harder to find those values at the wing spot. Ideally, you do both. Ideally, you add two starting level players at both spots and invest in both. But based on some of the cap restraints for the Lakers here, when factoring in, they will also want to retain some of their own free agents. I think I would be okay with saving on one and between the two, probably saving on the center spot. Next question from Reeves Depressed Soldier. Why is the AR discussion from this series so negative when his production has been in line with other star guards versus OKC? Austin is a polarizing player and you just have to tune in to one of my post-game shows to understand that, get the reaction from both sides. Like, regardless of how well Austin plays or how poorly Austin plays, there's going to be people defending him and there's going to be people criticizing him. I mean, a big thing has been he's obviously in a contract year and a lot is being made about his next contract and where he slots and where he fits in the Lakers hierarchy. And he's been under the microscope this year because every game, every performance has been building towards his next contract and what his value truly is, right? So I think part of it has been that, and there's just been a lot of pressure, a lot of speculation, a lot of spotlight and attention on Austin this year. And every little thing has been overanalyzed, overscrutinized. Now, to your point, I'm going to put the graphic up here. But if you look at Austin's averages in the series, he was in line with several guys who are on max contracts or all-star level guards. And it's not to say that he's better than any of these guys or that he's on the level of all these guys, but it is to show that OKC is the toughest matchup in the NBA for backcourt players. And Austin held his own in a way that several other guys that are making far more money than him and will still be making far more money than him after his next contract did not perform. And Austin did it as the number one ball handler against OKC and the number two usage guy against OKC. And so he was in a role that he will not be in against OKC in the future when Luka's back. Like, Luka will be the number one ball handler against them. Austin will be the number two. And from a usage percentage, if LA still has LeBron or they add Giannis or they add another star, then I think Austin will be the number three in usage. And so we saw Austin in a role that he will not necessarily be in against OKC in the future. I think he'll be slotted a little bit lower in the hierarchy, but even being in a tougher role, even with not having much time to recover and get his legs under him, like I don't think he was the same player physically that he was before the injury. I think it's very clear on film that Austin was not as quick, did not have his handle or his shot to the same level, and that was reflected with some of the turnovers and the shooting numbers that he had, you know, particularly from deep. He was not the same level of player, but he still found ways to be effective. He still found ways to get downhill, create separation. He did much better against OKC after game one. Game one was an abject disaster. Games two to games four, he was much better. For the series, averaged 21 points and 7 assists against OKC. If you take out game one, which is obviously favorable for Austin, but I did take him a game to start to figure out the OKC defense and for the Lakers to make some adjustments with how they used him. Games two to games four, he averaged 25 points per game, 7 assists per game, shot 51% overall and 39% on threes. So if I told you Austin averaged 25-7 on 51% shooting and 39% against OKC, you would take that 10 out of 10 times. Now, there will be some pushback here, and I understand. I think the things to be critical of were the turnovers are far too high. Like game four, 8 turnovers that really cost the Lakers. Now, again, I would also state that he's not going to be the primary ball handler against them and he'll be more of a secondary guy, but he struggled with turnovers against OKC and several elite teams all season. So that's a real concern and that's a real thing that he has to address this offseason in terms of getting better with his handle and his decision-making against some of these elite defenses that are going to pressure him. And when they throw the blitzes, when they're in rotation, he's got to make better reads there. You also have to look at the defense where the numbers are not showing the defensive end, but he was targeted in both series by Houston and OKC on the defensive end. And that's an area that he needs to get back to being the defender he was his first couple of years in the league. And I think the biggest area, in my opinion, where he looked not right was his lateral quickness defensively. He's never been a lockdown defender, but one of Austin's defensive strengths, or at least areas he's been able to hold his own in, is with his quickness, right? If you're looking at what would be a physical advantage for him defensively, he is pretty quick for his size and for his position. So he has had playoff series and games where one of his best things, I think, is chasing guys around screens and mirroring their footwork and just sticking with guys because that's where he can leverage that speed. That was not the same level in the playoffs. So I think if he can get right, and that's about to touch on that, then I think you'll see a better defensive performance from that perspective. But obviously he can be attacked off the dribble. AJ Mitchell cooked him. He can be, you know, when he's mismatches in the paint, it's Chet, Isaiah Hartenstein, Şengün. Those guys are getting offensive rebounds. Those guys are getting putbacks. Like, that's a real limitation with him defensively. The other thing would be the three-point shooting, which to me is arguably the biggest concern. His three-point shooting has been bad for 3 straight postseasons. Some of the stuff with the turnovers, some of the stuff with the defense, I think that could all be better in the future. The three-point shooting, we do have enough of a sample size here where that one I'm a little bit more concerned with that and again it's probably related to the physical component here of his body holding up, but he just has not been able to maintain his jumper into the playoffs. And that would be something I am slightly concerned with. And then the final thing would just be overall, it's now been three straight postseasons where he's been dealing with something. Now, it only really impacted his games played this season with the calf injury during the middle portion of the season and then eventually the oblique injury. But if you go back to last postseason with the toe stuff, and I just constantly having some lower extremity stuff that I think affects his physical state and also affects his jumper to a degree, and something he's going to have to address either with his body or his play style or something, because I think he does need to hold up better physically deeper into the season. But Austin's production was in line with a lot of these guys. Several of these guys were also targeted defensively in their respective series. So I think the Austin stuff in the playoffs has been overblown. If we're looking back, like, people have retroactively applied this. Well, he's never scored over 23 points, which he did twice in the OKC series. But like before that point, he's never scored over 23 points in a playoff series. But Austin, if you go back and look at Austin's usage and his role slotting, like, people have had revisionist history of acting like he was some top three option. And go back to the first playoff run. He was fifth in the team in usage among the primary rotation. It was LeBron, AD, D'Lo, and Malik Beasley had a higher usage percentage. So Malik Beasley didn't play. I think he played in 11 of the 16 playoff games. Put him to the side because he's obviously playing a smaller role than Austin. But even then, Austin was behind D'Lo by several usage points and was the fourth option during that playoff run. And he was awesome in that playoff run. I think all three series, he was awesome. The Memphis series was his arrival, his coming out party. The Golden State series, I think he had a little bit of a dip there. But overall, I would say like half the series, he was at least good and up to par. And then the Denver series, he was easily their third best player. Same thing in 2024. Yet in 2024, he was also fourth on the team in usage and was playing fewer minutes than D'Lo. D'Lo averaged multiple minutes more per game than him. And D'Lo was once again ahead of Austin. Now, it was like a 1% usage gap. But point being is, Austin, like, how many fourth options are scoring 23 points or more in a playoff game? You might have a random performance where you do that. But Austin, through his first two playoff runs, was the number four option. D'Lo averaged more shot attempts than Austin. D'Lo had a higher usage than Austin. And in 2024, D'Lo played more than Austin in that Denver series, which is inexplicable because Austin was better than him on both sides of the ball. Now, 2025, Austin gets scaled up into that third role behind Luka and LeBron, and he struggled. Now, we later found out that he was dealing with the toe stuff, but I'm not going to use that as an excuse. Like, he was not up to par of what LA needed in that series. He was not up to par of being a true number three. But this postseason, he now comes back and is the number two behind LeBron, number one ball handler, but number two in usage. And he was much better than even last season. Like, if you had this version of Austin in last playoffs against the Wolves, I think the Lakers at least pushed that series to six games. So like, Austin was objectively better in this playoffs than he was last playoffs. And he did so coming off of an injury, clearly not being physically right, and doing it against a better defense in part. You know, four of the six games he played in were against OKC, much better defense than Minnesota last year. So I think Austin showed that, can he be a number two on a championship team? At this point, I don't think we have 100% clarity, but I would say no. I think he should be the number three on a championship team or slotted number three in the offensive hierarchy, pecking order, whatever. But some of the narratives with the playoff stuff, I think, has just been completely overblown. I think there's been a lot of revisionist history on what his role used to be. Can he be better taking care of the ball? Can he be better defensively? Can he be better as a shooter? And does he need to work on his body to hold up better? Yes, 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 yes. All those things are yes. But even with some of those struggles, and he clearly struggled in some regards, I think people are acting like he was absolutely atrocious when averaging 21-7 against the Oklahoma City Thunder is just objectively good. And again, you look at the class of guards that have gone up against them in playoff series over the last couple of years, and Austin is in line or near the top. And even in factoring in some of his shooting struggles, like looking at true shooting and effective field goal percentage, he's right there with all those guys. And so, can he be better? Yes. Are there some limitations and weaknesses with Austin that you have to game plan around? Yes. Is the fit with Luka and Austin perfect? No, I think there's an open-ended question as to like whether they truly can be two of the top three guys together on a championship team. But some of the stuff that some of the takes with Austin, some of the analysis, I think, has just been completely overblown, completely misinformed, and just inaccurate. And that's my take on the Austin discourse. Next one from Kane. If LeBron wants similar to what he's making right now, what should the Lakers do? This question was submitted before some of the recent reporting coming out from the LeBron / clutch side about LeBron and his value and feeling a bit taken advantage of by the Lakers or and LA having to court him to some degree this summer and really sell him and pitch him on taking a pay cut. So this is a very timely question. And I don't have a great answer for you. I think if you are looking at LeBron's playoff performance and LeBron's performance as a number one option, you can really make the case that he is still in that 40, 45, maybe even $50 million price range. But based on the Lakers' finances, there is a path here for them to just run it back, use bird rights on LeBron, on Rui, on Marcus, on Luke, and just run it back with the same group, depending on where some of those numbers come in. Maybe let's just say, for simplicity's sake, they run it back and you just use the non-taxpayer mid-level exception on one player. So you have 15, 16 million to add one guy and then a bunch of minimum contracts. Like, the question is that enough for the Lakers to truly contend? And I would say no. I think if you run it back with this core and just add one mid-level player, which you might not even be able to get a starting level player for that money. And I think LA needs two more starting level players, not just one. But let's just say they get lucky and someone takes a discount or something. They use that. Quite frankly, based on Marcus's bird rights, you might have to use the mid-level or part of it on him to retain him. I don't think the bump on his contract is going to be enough to keep him with the market I think Marcus is about to have. But for argument's sake, let's just say Marcus accepts the bird right bump that the Lakers can give him, and they use that non-taxpayer MLE. They get a Mitchell Robinson or Kelly Oubre or someone like that. Is just adding that player to this group enough? I would say no. And I just don't think that makes enough of a difference. It could be a step in the right direction, but I don't think that materially changes the Lakers' ability to compete with OKC or San Antonio. So I think the big thing here is for LA to really improve the roster, they need to use their cap space. Again, you can run it back and you can maybe do some sign-in trades or later flip guys in the season or whatever. There are ways to improve the roster at some point down the line. But if you're trying to build a roster now, the primary way to do that is going to be with that cap space and to either sign someone or trade for someone or both. And so that is going to require LeBron to take a pay cut. And the question is, of course, where's that number? What is the number that is high enough for LeBron where he doesn't feel disrespected, where he feels valued? And where's that number that's low enough for the Lakers where they can still make improvements to the roster? I've thrown out, I think, 20 to 25 million. Reason being, that's more than LeBron will get from his primary suitors. If you look at the teams that he's been attached to, they all have between either minimum contracts to upwards of the non-taxpayer MLE, which starts out about 15, 16 million or so. So if you're offering LeBron 20 million or 25 million, you're going above that 16 million and much higher than the minimum, but you're not quite at that $50 million level. So, but based on the reporting from this week and some of the stuff that's come out, it doesn't seem like that's the way he views it. Doesn't seem like that would be a number he'd be interested in. So it will, like, it feels like the Lakers are going to have to court him, are going to have to make him feel valued, or are going to have to make him feel appreciated, and then also sell him on taking a pay cut and have a plan in place of not just running it back and saying, okay, well, we want to pay Rui and Marcus, and like, so we need you to take a pay cut. It needs to be, we need you to take a pay cut because we're getting Walker Kessler or Jalen Duren or Peyton Watson or someone like that. That's really going to make a difference to our roster. If it's a binary decision of LeBron tells the Lakers 50 million or bust, this is just speculation here, so please do not aggregate me. But my read on that situation would be the Lakers would just say, we're going to pass and we're not going to sign you to that type of contract. So I do think if they come to some sort of agreement, it will be at a lower number. Maybe the Lakers go up to even 30 million. I think that's probably the most they would realistically do. I do not see the Lakers paying him 35, 40, 45, 50. The one way that would make some sense is, again, if they don't like their options in free agency in the trade market, they decide to just run it back, pay guys with bird rights, and then try to do some moves later in, into the season ahead of the trade deadline. You could go that route, but that is sort of kicking the can down the road. That is I think just not making enough of an improvement to the roster. And I would wonder how Luka would feel about that, of just, you know, let's run it back, but like hope in the future that we can trade some of these guys and make some moves. Like, I think it would be better to build the roster now. And so it's a tough question to answer in a vacuum, but if LeBron wants 45, 50 million, I don't think the Lakers are going to pay him that much. And I think it sets up a potentially awkward situation. I think from the Lakers side, you're going to be like, well, you might be worth that, right? And you showed that you're an all-star, you still put up good numbers, you were the number one option on a team that won a first-round playoff series, but you also want to win championships. And with our current finances, the way to win championships is to improve the roster. And to do that, we need you to take a pay cut. And also, even with taking the pay cut, you're going to be getting much more money than anywhere else. And so it's like, if the Lakers are like, we'll pay you $25 million, but Cleveland can pay you the minimum, like, you really want to take $22 million less than what we're offering you, or 21, whatever the difference ends up being, and go to Cleveland and have to relocate? Does he want to go through that and make far less money? And that's just a question that only LeBron can answer, right? But I still think they find some common ground, but it is going to be at a number that's probably lower than LeBron wants. And it might end up being a number that's maybe higher than the Lakers want. But I still think that the best outcome for both parties is for them to end up together at an appropriate number. Who knows? Maybe the number gets low enough where a team is able to step in and be like, we want to sign and trade for LeBron, or they could even clear enough cap space where, like, no one has $50 million in cap space necessarily outside of Chicago and Brooklyn. But can someone get to $20 million in cap space and actually make the Lakers sweat? That's a possibility here. And so in a binary sense, I would say the Lakers are not going to pay him 45, 50 million. I just don't see that happening. Again, maybe there's an exception where the free agent market does not go in LA's favor. The trade market doesn't really materialize, and the best option is to run it back and then to try to make some moves down the road. But I think that'd be really disappointing for the fan base with how big of an offseason this is. And so I think if the two sides do agree to some sort of deal, which I still think is the most likely scenario, it is going to be at a lower price, somewhere in that $20 to $25 million range, maybe upwards of 30, but I don't see it going much, if higher at all. And final one from Teske: Rui has been great, but I don't think he should be back. I don't think people realize, he puts in quotes, not you, how much bringing these same guys back basically means we're running it back with a team that isn't even a true contender and would waste all of next year, in my opinion. To the spirit of this question, I've talked about this several times before, where oftentimes when I see people proposing some form of the Lakers roster, it is far too aggressive in terms of, they're like, can we add these three players who are all going to be making double-digit millions and keep LeBron and keep Marcus and keep Rui, and then like dump Vando and DA and all these guys for like one first-round pick? And it's just like, that's not realistic. That's not how this is going to play out. And so I think from the Lakers' perspective, they are going to prioritize Austin and finding a number that is appropriate for both sides there. They'll keep him on that cap hold and operate with the cap space and make their moves, but you know, eventually sign Austin, but they'll agree to it beforehand. Then there'll be the matter of what happens with LeBron and his contract, and if he is back or not. Then I think Marcus will be the priority, and then Rui fourth behind that. And just look at how Rob Pelinka answered some of the questions at exit interviews. He had far more conviction talking about Austin Reeves and the mutual interest and how they view him as a part of the future, and how he's expressed interest in staying and how the Lakers want him to stay, compared to LeBron and Rui. I think reading between the tea leaves with Rui and basically anyone that's not Austin, I think there is some wiggle room in terms of LA is not like 100% or even like 95% bringing them back. Whereas Austin, I think he's going to be back. It's just what the number looks like. So with Rui, I think it depends on the alternatives here, right? There are pathways in which, like, to me, again, it's Austin and LeBron and Marcus, and those are the top three guys to retain. And then once you get to Rui, that's the point for me where it really just depends on what type of contract he wants, what type of contract, you know, what's his market, and then also what are the alternatives? Because at the Rui point in retaining guys is where I think it becomes, okay, well, like, would you rather have Rui or would you rather have Tari Eason? Or would you rather have Rui or would you rather make the contract offer for Kessler or Dort? Like, he might come at the expense of the big splash in free agency or via trade,
Whereas the other, like Austin is separate because he's not even a part of the cap space conversation. LeBron is part of the cap space conversation and will determine how much cap space the Lakers have. Either he resigns for a lower number and they have X amount, or he leaves and they have the maximum amount. Then Marcus, depending on if he takes the room exception or like some slice of the cap space, that also plays a role in all this. And then if the Lakers can clear some additional money, also plays a role in all this. But their ability to add another player of impact, and ideally another player above the non-taxpayer MLE range, which would be them outbidding other suitors, probably starts with whether they keep Rui or not, because I made this point before. If you keep Rui, Marcus, and LeBron, like you can use bird rights, but with all those guys and technically go above the cap, though it gets a little tricky with Marcus. But then you're basically just running it back, right? Like there's a scenario in which maybe you have a little bit of cap space left over if they all take discounts. And so Rui might be the point of, what's the alternative? If you can get the RFA, if you can get the Lou Dort or whoever off the trade market, you go that route. If you don't, if all the RFAs and top free agents re-sign or sign elsewhere, if the trade market doesn't really materialize, or maybe those guys are available, but they don't want to trade them to the Lakers for a variety of reasons, then I think you look at Rui and you're like, okay, maybe we do run it back to some extent, or maybe at that point you have lost LeBron and it does make more sense to keep Rui or whatever. So there's a lot, like with all these answers, there's just a lot of nuance and a lot of if A, then B, then C, or if A, then B, then D. Like it just can go in so many different ways that it's really tough to give blanket statements with all of the offseason analysis as of right now. So I'm trying to talk through different scenarios, different hypotheticals, in different ways it could just all play out. But with Rui, I think he's at a point in the offseason pecking order where it could be picking between Rui or making a splashier addition. And that's just going to be something the Lakers are going to have to figure out, and figure out how much they value him compared to some of the other options out there. But with all that said, I appreciate you guys watching and listening. I'll be back later in the week. Be on the lookout on YouTube and X and Discord. I'll talk to you all soon.